All right, so this is Lecture 6 of the Introduction to C++, and today we're going to talk about floating point and pointers. If you have any comments or questions or anything, feel free, as always, to post them in the chat room, and I'll be monitoring that as we go along and hopefully answering some questions. So I'm going to start off with slide 3, and we're going to talk about some more different variables. So some variables are floating point. Up until now, we've been talking about integers. We've been talking about the data types int, long, short, and char, or car. And those variables have all stored integer values, or whole numbers. They didn't have a decimal portion, and they couldn't go very high. In fact, our long integer could only go up to about 4 billion, which isn't that high on the scale of things. So what if we want to represent numbers that have decimal points? Well, then we have to use some different types of storage mechanisms. We went over in detail the storage mechanisms of the integers, for example, the short and the long, 16-bit. We went over how we represent negative numbers by adding the 7th bit on the left for a byte being the sign of the variable, or in general, the most significant bit in general is the sign of the variable. However, today we're going to talk about floating point, and these schemes are a little more complicated than the integer schemes, so we're not going to go into exactly how every single number in Mantissa and everything is stored inside the variable. So today we're just going to go over what the variable types are and what values we can store into them. And it used to be, back in the DOS days and before we had 3D graphics, that everyone used integer types because they were a lot faster than floating point. In fact, back when the 386 processor was started, it was released without any floating point capabilities. And actually, all the processors before the 386 didn't have floating point possibilities even. So the 386 processor, they released an add-on that was a floating point processor, so that you could add a floating point processor on. It was kind of like a coprocessor, and that coprocessor could handle floating point. So this really brought up our ability to process floating point numbers. It used to be that integer addition and everything was a lot faster than floating point addition and subtraction and multiplication and division, but nowadays they're pretty much the same, floating point and integer operations. So in today's games, especially when we're doing three-dimensional graphics, floating point is used a lot. And it's especially handy, like if you try to do the line algorithm, you'll notice that Bresenham's algorithm is all done in integers. And that's because back when in Bresenham's days, integers were a lot faster to manipulate than floating point. And most of the speed increase in Bresenham's algorithm was due to the fact that he didn't use floating point, that all he used was integers. One of the disadvantages to using floating point when we're talking about graphics is that every pixel is discrete. We specify pixels by being like third from the left-hand side of the screen, or fourth, or fifth. We don't think of variables, or we don't think of pixels being 4.5 pixels away from one. They're very discrete. So in slide number 4, there are only really two different types of floating point variables. There's the float and the double. And there's also a long double, which it has even more precision than the double. But in general, you don't need that high of precision. So notice that when we talk about floating point variables, the smallest one we have is 32 bits. And the 32 bits they can represent large numbers. On the left there, these are all expressed in scientific notation. So when we put that E in there, that means, for example, for the rightmost number in the float, 3.4 times 10 to the 38th power. So that's a huge number. And we can also extend the decimal place out some more than what I represented here, but I just didn't want it to go on and on forever. So we can represent very large numbers. 10 to the 38th power is very large, and we can go down to negative 38, which is 10 to the negative 38th power, which is very small numbers. If we think about it in relation to the metric system, e to the negative 12 is pico. If we think about atoms, then an atom diameter is just a few angstroms wide, which is 10 to the negative 9th meters. And here we can go down to 10 to the negative 38th meters, and that's pretty small. And then with the double, note that here we're using 64 bits to represent a double. And it looks like there's something wrong with my connection. Oh! Hello, 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 hello. Do you guys want me to start over? Okay, I accidentally set my voice activation level to be too low, so people on TeamSpeak couldn't hear every other word. So back to slide number 4, again, when we're representing a float, then we can go, the e represents 10 to the power. So for the rightmost number, we have 3.4 times 10 to the 38th power, which is a huge number, and the number on the left there is times 10 to the negative 38th power. And a nanometer is 10 to the negative 9th meters. An angstrom is about the width of an atom, and that's 10 to the negative 9th meters. So we can go down to 10 to the negative 38 meters, and that's very small. So this should be good for a lot of our needs. And in fact, when the original Pentium was introduced, a professor found a flaw in its handling of floating point, and that caused a big recall of the Pentium chips. So that's an interesting bit of history, I guess. And so ever since the 386 processor add-on, our floating point processor was about the same speed as our normal processor in handling integers and floating point numbers. And this same amount of speed is inherent in today's graphics. Because today we work a lot with three-dimensional points, and we transform our coordinate system so that they're much easier to think about than having 640 pixels wide by 480 down. What if the left-hand side of the screen was 1 and the right-hand side was negative 1, or opposite that? That's a lot easier for us to think about, and it would scale appropriately for lots of different coordinates. So if our screen was 1024 by 768, if we still define the left side as negative 1 and the right side as 1, then it still works out perfectly. So that's what they normally do with three-dimensional graphics, and that's why floating point is such a good use in computer graphics nowadays. Okay, so going on to slide number 5, you probably saw this before. This was on the cfweb.net. This is sort of an algorithm for drawing a line using the DDA algorithm, I accidentally put an if there instead of a for. The if and for thing was actually a mistake on their site, and I thought I fixed it, but I forgot to replace the if with a for. Yet, the DDA algorithm is just a method of drawing a line that we're all familiar with. We find the y-intercept of the line, and we find the slope of the line, and with those two pieces of data, we can graph the equation y equals mx plus b. So this is a pretty easy algorithm to look at, but the important part is that we're using floats here, because we need to get the slope to be very accurate. If our slope is actually 4.5, and we can only use integers to represent it, that would be truncated to 4. and every other pixel would be 2 pixels down from what it should be, or 1 pixel down from what it should be. And that could cause big problems if we're spanning over a 100 pixel wide range. And also note the use of casting there at the bottom. Note that because the y variable is a float, we have to cast it to an integer before we put it into the putPixel routine. And this casting to an integer is very important, because we can't pass a floating point value to the screen. Remember that pixels aren't 4.5 pixels over, but pixels are instead discrete values. They're integer values. And so that's why we need to cast it to an integer. So Slavik asked, what happens when you cast a float to an int? The float is truncated. So the decimal value that comes to the right of the decimal of the point there is just cut off. It's automatically rounded down. And that rounding down is just for convenience. There are actually some routines in the math library called floor and seal, and seal will always round up and floor will round down. And you can also easily write your own rounding function, which is what a lot of people do if you actually have to round. So, with the DDA algorithm, like we said yesterday, we have to get a point for every single pixel. So we start at the leftmost pixel, which is x1, and we go to the rightmost pixel, which is x2. And every single pixel, we have to plot a point, and then using the y equals mx plus b, or in this case, y equals kx plus b formula, we calculate what the y value should be for every point. And then we truncate that y value. So on to slide number 6. So what is all this casting stuff? Well, here's an example. In this example, we have an x position, and we have the dx position. D stands for delta. So we're going to move the x position 0.1 every single cycle. We're going to add on 0.1 every cycle. And then we also have an integer x. That's evidently not used here. So we have while the x position is less than 640, so before it reaches the right-hand side of the screen, every single pixel, we're going to increment the xpos by the dxpos. So we're going to increment it by segments of 0.1, and then we're going to call the setPixel routine. And note, I didn't do an explicit cast here, but since the setPixel routine only requires integers, it's going to automatically truncate that. And that's a bad situation to be in, because in this situation, we're incrementing by 0.1 every time. So I'm going to be setting this pixel 10 times for every single pixel on the screen. And I'd never know about it if I didn't look at this routine very carefully. So that's one of the situations where I might want to look very critically at my use of floating point. So, in C, to cast an integer, you had to do float and then the integer. So why is it float and then the integer? If you want to cast an integer to a float, then you can, like if we look in slide number 5, then we're putting in, at the top there we have float and then we have the division. And our question is, why is it float integer? And actually in this situation it looks like I might have misplaced the parentheses too. I mainly just copied this off of CFX website, so maybe I should look at this again. But perhaps we should the safest way to do it is to independently cast every single variable to a float. So the best way to do this is probably to place every single variable in that k equals statement and cast it as a float independently. And that way you can guarantee that your resulting expression will be a float, because that's a pretty good way of doing things. If you're not sure of what's going on, just go ahead and cast every single variable as what you hope the resulting expression to be. But in this case, since we're storing all this stuff in a float, if we only turn the top value into a float, the bottom value, x2 minus x1, will automatically be promoted to a floating point from an integer. So actually, in this case, the k equals thing will work, because y2 minus y1, that's an integer minus an integer, so the result will be an integer. And then we'll convert that to a floating point, so we'll have a floating point on top. x2 minus x1 will be evaluated, and that's an integer. And then we have a division left, and our top value is a float, and our bottom value is an integer. Since one of them is a float, then the integer will be cast to a float, and then we'll evaluate the expression and store it into k, which is also a float. So I think in this case it will work out. But in general, if you want to make sure that everything's going on right and nothing's being truncated, I'd actually cast every single variable in there, unless if you know the promotion rules very well. All right, so we are on slide number 7 now, and I'm going to go into pointers now, and we're going to see how far we get here. So slide number 7 doesn't look like a good slide, so let's go to slide number 8. Looks like I didn't delete slide number 7, so I'm going to have to redo some of these slides, so I'll post them again after the lecture. But on slide number 8, we're going into pointers. And pointers are often considered by students one of the most difficult parts of C and C++ programming. And whenever I use C/C++, that means it's used in both C and C++. And so far, everything we've talked about is in C and in C++. So, what is a pointer? So a pointer is just like any other variable in C or C++ that we've talked about. You can think of it as kind of like an unsigned long. It can hold any value, and it's always a whole number, it's always an integer, and it can have any value from 0 to 4 billion and some. And one way to look at these pointer things is that, remember that limit in Windows of having 4 gigabytes of RAM? Well, where does that number come from? If you noticed before that if we do 2 to the 32nd, we get about 4.3 billion. And if every single one of those numbers addresses 1 byte in memory, then that gives us about 4 gigabytes of memory. So that's where our 4 gigabyte limit on RAM comes in, because if we use an absolute addressing scheme where every single number in a variable points to a single byte, then that comes out to 4 billion bytes. And that's 4 gigabytes. So that's kind of the derivation of where we got that 4 gigabyte limit. And if you go down to 16 bits, you might be able to get some of the old limits. In fact, one of the earliest limits was 640 kilobytes. And there's a way we can derive that too. So just remember that a pointer is an address in memory, or it just has an address stored as an unsigned long, basically. So on slide number 9, so whenever we allocate memory for a variable, then we allocate some memory inside the user's RAM in most cases. And so let's say we have a huge row of mailboxes, and every single mailbox has a number on it, and the number starts at 0 and goes up until 4 billion some. So if I'm driving down and I have a number that I need to look up, I'll drive down the row of mailboxes until I get to that number. Then I'll open it up and see what's inside. So this is exactly like how a pointer is going to work. Every single mailbox, in this case, can hold 1 byte of data, or 8 bits. And we can address which mailbox we want to look into by having a single 32-bit number, which is why the 4 gigabyte thing is so convenient. So if we go on to slide number 10, let's take a look at how these pointers are represented in C and C++. So next to every single data type, to the left of our variable, we have an identifier, for example, int, or long, or float. So if we look at the statement, well, first of all, to note that all pointers are always 32 bits in length, because an address is always going to be 32 bits long. And this 32-bit limit is, again, because we have a 32-bit processor, and that's the number we can hold. And thus, we can address 4 gigabytes of memory at the most, 4 gigabytes of RAM. So let's say that I just want a pointer to a certain memory address. So in that pointer, I'm just going to store some value. It's just going to point to some memory address. So if I use the type void star, then I can declare a variable to point to some memory address. And in my two examples, I have void star video buffer equals 0xA0000000. And that's actually an address stored in hexadecimal. And in the olden DOS days and early command line Linux days, that's where the video buffer actually was in memory. That's where our VGA buffer is. If we want to do VGA graphics, we'd always start at that address in memory. So that's one way to assign an address to a variable. Secondly, up top, we have void star my pointer equals null. And this is another important thing to think about in variable when we're doing pointers. Null is always defined as zero or nothing. So an equivalent statement would be void star my pointer equals zero. However, it's important to distinguish between what's a pointer and what's a value, because a pointer points to a memory address and a value can be zero. So whenever we have a pointer that points to null or points to zero, then that means it does not point to a memory address, because nothing can be stored at the memory address zero. So this is kind of like an uninitialized pointer. And it is true, like Slavik said, that null is pound defined. So null is not something that's defined in C, in the C language, but often programmers will pound define that, or it's usually included in most .h files, or not in most .h files, but when you do a project, it'll usually be defined for you. So whenever pointers are not in use, you'll always want to set them to null, meaning that they don't point to anything. On slide number 11, let's take a look at how we can store things in pointers. So before we looked at void star, which meant that was just a generic pointer that pointed to something, somewhere. And in our below examples, we have an unsigned int pointer and a float pointer. The important thing to remember here that whenever you see that asterisk, we always allocate 32 bits of memory for that pointer. No more, no less, because a memory address always takes 32 bits of storage. So just because I put a data type in front of that asterisk, it doesn't mean that for the float I'm going to allocate 32 bits, but for the char I'm going to allocate 8 bits. Means that both of these are pointers, and for both cases we're going to allocate 32 bits. So what's the difference between the unsigned int pointer and the float pointer? Well, for one thing, the important distinction is that all that the variable type does on the left, all that that does is tell us whether we're pointing to an integer or to a float. So we're telling the compiler for the bank salary that you can interpret the data that's stored at the address stored in bank salary as a float. Or you can refer to the data stored at the address stored in video buffer as an unsigned int. So we're saying that if you go to that memory address, then you can interpret the value stored there as an unsigned int, or you can interpret that value as a float. But in all cases, this pointer value is going to be 32 bits. That's the important thing to remember. So in slide number 12, Let's see how we can assign a value to a pointer so it's a little more useful to us. So normally, if we have like int total monsters equals 100, we've worked with that a lot. When we reference this variable as total monsters, then we grab what's stored in that variable. So we grab what is stored in total monsters. And when we call int total monsters, then we're allocating a piece of memory inside RAM at a certain address, and we're sticking that value 100 into that address. So if we have a pointer that's defined, then it's just like a regular unsigned long, except it has a value in it. And that value happens to be an address. So in the little example on that page 12 there, then we have an integer total monsters, and we have a value 100 stored in the variable total monsters. So that means we allocated a space in RAM, we allocated 4 bytes in RAM for total monsters, and we stored the value 100 into it. So after that, I'm declaring and defining a variable called pointer total monsters. And this is going to allocate 32 bits of memory because it's a pointer. And we're telling the compiler this value is going to be pointing to an integer somewhere in memory. So I'm telling it here, note the ampersand in front of total monsters. Whenever I put an ampersand in front of a normal variable, I'm getting that variable's address in memory. So the value stored in total monsters is 100, but the address of total monsters is something completely different. And remember that a pointer holds an address, so it's going to take the address that total monsters is stored at, and it's going to store that address in the pointer. So note the use of the ampersand. If you forget that ampersand, then that means that the pointer total monsters is going to point to the 100th byte in memory. And that's not what we want, because we have no idea what's stored at the 100th byte in memory, and we don't care what's stored there. We only care about where total monsters is in memory. So in slide number 13, let's take another look at this. Again, we have int total monsters equals 100, then we have a pointer to the total monsters. And we're taking the address of the variable total monsters, and we're storing it in this new pointer that we just allocated. So we're going to have 3 cout statements. The first is going to output 100. Because this is what we've always been doing, we're going to output the value of the variable total monsters. The second one is going to output some weird memory address. Note that we're just referring to pointer total monsters, and we know that what's stored in pointer total monsters is just an address. And then thirdly, note that this time we have an asterisk in front of it. Whenever we put an asterisk in front of this pointer variable, we're referring to the contents that are stored at the address that's stored in the variable. So pointer total monsters contains an address pointing to total monsters. So when I put a star in front of pointer total monsters, I'm referring to the variable total monsters, because the address of the variable total monsters is stored in pointer total monsters. So this is kind of crazy, but in the third C out there, it's going to print 100 too, because pointer total monsters contains the address of total monsters. And by putting the asterisk in front of it, I'm referring to get me the value of the variable that is being pointed to by pointer total monsters. And you'll have to use this a few times and see. And I know right now it seems a little weird, and why would I ever do this? But hopefully later in this lecture you'll see why. It's very handy. In slide number 14, let's take a look at passing by value. Here's one of the applications of this. So this is something else that's really important to look at. when we normally call a function, all the variables that we pass to it are copied. So whenever we call setPixel, every single variable you pass is copied. So if I pass it a y value and an x value, then those two values are copied. So if I pass the setPixel function xres and or if I pass the setPixel value xpos and ypos, then if I alter those two values inside the function, the original xpos and ypos aren't going to change. So the question becomes, what if I want to alter those xpos and ypos values? What if I want to alter the ones that I pass into the function? So one way of doing this is using pointers, because even if a pointer is copied, we can still have the address of the original variable intact, so we can still modify its contents. So when we use pointers, we're sending the address of variables to our function, not the contents of the variables. And because we're passing the address of the variables, we can reference that address inside the function and modify the contents of these variables. So this is one of the power of pointers. This is one of the powers of pointers, because this way we can modify certain values inside functions that we normally could not modify, because the functions themselves make copies of the parameters we pass in. So on slide number 15, let's take a look at this pointer passing thing. So some people might call this pointing by address, or passing by address, because you're sending a variable by its address rather than its value. So this often saves time, because let's say we have a huge array or something that we need to pass to a function. We don't want to copy the entire array and then send it to the function. We just want to send a pointer to the array, so that making that copy of the 32-bit value is a lot faster than a whole array. So another advantage of pointers in this situation is that not only can we alter the original variable that we pass in, and not only is it faster to pass this, we also know that 32 bits per value are being copied, and 32 bits per value are being sent to the function. So, I mean, if we are going to send characters to a function, it might be worth our while just to send a character if we don't have to send the pointer. So you kind of have to weigh what'll be better than something else. Usually, if you don't care about modifying the variable that's sent to a function, and if you don't care about saving time, if the variable is an integer, you might as well just pass it as an integer and not as a pointer, for instance. So let's take a look at our two little functions here, addNum1 and addNum2. So addNum1, we have an integer, and the sum. And what we're trying to do is we want the result to be stored in the sum. So if we take a look at this code segment here, we have that the sum is equal to the num1 plus num2. So we'll look on the right side, and num1 plus num2 is some value. And that's evaluated, and it's going to return an integer. And then in this case, we're storing that integer into the pointer sum. However, this isn't the right way to do it. This is how we might have been doing it in the past. But in this case, the sum is a pointer. So the result of num1 plus num2 is going to be stored in the copy of the address that is passed to the function. So in this case, the local variable sum is going to store the sum of num1 and num2. And nothing is really going to happen. So if we look at addNum2, the second version of the function, this is more like what we want. So if I call the function addNum2 and I send it a variable for sum, the address of a variable for sum, then in this case, I'm storing the contents of that address. I'm storing the sum of num1 and num2 into the contents of the address that sum points to. And this is what we want, because note that the 32-bit value for sum was copied when we called the function, so this int star sum variable is a copy of the original address, but the value, the variable that that points to, is still intact. It's still the exact same value being pointed to, whether we're inside the function or not. So in this case, when I put an asterisk in front of the sum, I'm saying I want the contents of this sum to be equal to num1 plus num2. So let's take a look at another example of that. Slide number 16. So here we're going to take a look at passing by address. So in my main function, I'm going to define two integers, num1 and sum, and I'm going to define one pointer. Again, I'm setting that initially equal to null, implying that it doesn't point to anything. So I'm going to start off by calling my function addNums, which is exactly like the bottom, the addNum2 that we saw above. And I'm going to pass it num1, 10, and the value of sum. So num1 is equal to 5, so it's going to copy 5, and it's going to store it into the local variable num1 down in the addNums function. It's going to take the value of 10 and copy it into the num2 variable in the addNums function. And then finally, we're going to take the address of the variable sum, and I'm going to store that address into the pointer to sum that's in the addNums function. This is a little confusing in that I made the variables in the main function and the function body the same. They don't have to be the same. And then inside my addNums, note that I pass the address to the variable sum, and that address is stored in the variable local variable sum within addNums. So when I say asterisk sum, I'm referring to the contents of whatever is pointed to by the variable sum. In this case, the variable in the main function sum is being pointed to. So since it's being pointed to, and I only sent a copy of the address over to addNums, when I calculate that sum, I'm going to be storing it into the main variable sum, and that value is going to be changed. So when I go back to the main function, that sum value isn't going to equal zero anymore. And that's pretty neat. Now, a second way of doing this is through using a variable. I've also declared the integer pointer sum variable, and I'm going to say that pointer sum is equal to the address of sum, so I'm storing the at where sum is located in memory into the variable pointer sum. And then when I add the nums, I can directly pass it a pointer, because pointer sum is referring to an address. So this bottom addNum statement is exactly the same as the top addNum statement. It's just stated in a little different way. Just like I can replace that 10 with a variable, it's exactly the same thing. So in slide number 17, that is also a duplicate. So let's go to slide number 18. I'll have to edit these slides a little afterward and post the result. In this case, we're going to be lighting a pixel. And this is one exciting consequence of pointers. So in this case, we have a pointer to the start of our video memory, and I'm storing it in a variable called vidbuf. And notice that it's a pointer, it's pointing to an unsigned integer. And this unsigned integer is just a 32-bit value in memory. So my vidbuf pointer is pointing to some 32-bit value in memory, and Initially, right now, I don't know where my video buffer is, so I'm going to set it to undefined, in that I don't know where this video buffer is yet, but it'll be defined somewhere later on. So the thing to realize again is that vidbuff, I'm allocating 32 bits of memory to store it in, and I know that whatever address is put into it, I'm going to be referring to a 32-bit value, an unsigned integer. So the deal here is that we also know that every 32-bit pixel is going to occupy 4 bytes of our memory. And from this, we can actually compute the location where we should store a certain pixel. So after we compute this value, then we can just store our 32-bit packed color value into that spot, and bang, a pixel will appear on the screen. And there's something called pointer arithmetic, which is nothing more than regular arithmetic that we can use to calculate this value. So, knowing what we did before from our pointer exploits on slide number 19, we're going to execute a simple little command. So star vidbuff, assuming that vidbuff points to the video buffer, is equal to the color red. So right now we know that when we put an asterisk in front of it, it refers to the contents of that address. So we're saying, I want you to put the color red at the very start of video buffer. So it's going to do that. And a pixel will light up in the upper left-hand corner of the screen. The top left pixel is going to be red. So let's be a little sneaky and say that I want the pixel right next to this lit up, one to the right of the leftmost, topmost pixel. So if I execute the statement, I want the pointer, or I want the contents of this vidbuff pointer plus 1 to be the color red, then that's going to set one pixel to the right of the leftmost, uppermost pixel to be red. Notice here, when I add 1, it moves forward one unsigned integer into memory. We know that the unsigned int is 4 bytes, so here I'm moving one space to the right in memory, and I'm storing that pixel. So when I add on 1, that's going 1 to the right of an unsigned integer. If I put a character there instead of unsigned integer, if this is a pointer to a character, it's only going to move 1 byte to the right. So to get the same effect, I'm going to have to add on 4 every time to move ahead 4 bytes. So that's one of the reasons why we want to put unsigned int or char or something in front of a pointer. Because yes, every single pointer is 32 bits long, but when we're doing pointer arithmetic, it really matters how long the value is that we're pointing to. So on slide number 20, let's take a look at some more pointer arithmetic. So first of all, that we know that the video buffer is made up of a buffer that has a lot of pixels in it. It has X-res across pixels, and it has Y-res down pixels. So there are X-res pixels per row. So if our screen is 640 across, then there are X-res pixels across, because X-res is equal to 640. The thing to remember here is that our memory is linear, and in fact, this is often called a linear frame buffer. So our memory is linear, meaning that we actually don't store all this memory in a two-dimensional array. We think about it two-dimensionally, but it's actually just one-dimensional. Hence, it's linear. So we can probably write an equation that specifies where our pixel should be stored. So let's think about this. So if I want the upper left-hand pixel, I'll just store a pixel immediately where my video buffer is. So like we did in slide number 19, we just put the asterisk right in front of it. So it's vidbuff plus 0. the contents of vidbluff plus 0 is equal to color red. So what if we want one y value down? Then I'm going to add on, 640. There are 640 pixels across, and I'm going 640 pixels across to get one row down. So if I add on 640, then that should give me exactly one row down from the topmost leftmost row. So, looking at our formula at the bottom of this screen, our y value is equal to 1, and our x value is equal to 0. So it's just vidbuff plus yres. And so that seems to be right. So what if I still want the top row, so y equals 0. And we already proved before that if I want one pixel to the right, I'm just going to add on 1, right? Because it skips ahead 1 4-byte segment. And again, I'll have to repost this slide. So again, we're going to have to add on 640 from the original to go one y pixel down. And the x pixels we just determined from slide 19 are just an offset from the upper leftmost pixel. So if I want to go one pixel to the right of that, then I'm just going to add on 1, because we're going to move forward 4 bytes at a time, since our pointer is an unsigned integer. The size of an unsigned integer is 4 bytes. So if I want 2 bytes from the leftmost uppermost, I'm just going to add on 2 to vidbuff. If I want 3 pixels to the right of the leftmost uppermost, I'm just going to add on 3 to vidbuff, and that'll light up the 3rd pixel. And so on. So hopefully that's a quick explanation of this formula. And the truth is that in actuality, it's a little more complicated than this, because we also have something called a pitch. And inside our video buffer on our video card, we have lots of resolutions that are supported. So to save memory and stuff like that, the pitch of a certain video mode is... Imagine that our 640 by 480 screen was actually much wider and longer than that. It had a higher height and a longer width. But we are only looking at the left upper part of this big black screen. And note that video cards only have one big segment of memory. So if I want to put a 640 by 480 screen in there, I'm only using a really small portion of that memory. And they need to have enough memory for a 1024 by 768 screen. So there's a lot of memory in there that might go unused. So for a 640 by 480, we might only use the upper left-hand part of this bigger piece of memory that would normally be used for the 1024 by 768. So to save memory, then we're not going to have a separate portion of memory set aside for every resolution. We're just going to have one block of memory set aside for the computer monitor, or the computer screen. So the pitch is how many bytes per line there are on the card. Not necessarily the number of visible bytes, but the number of bytes. So if you think about one huge black rectangle, if we have a 640 by 480 screen, that might be a smaller rectangle that's centered in the upper left. So to get to the next line, not only will we have to add on 640, but there's going to be some black space over to our right that we're going to have to skip over to get to the start of the second line. And this extra portion, the pitch, is the total number of bytes per line that may or may not be visible. So you also actually have to accommodate for that in your setPixel function. But assuming that there isn't any pitch, if we assume there isn't any pitch, then this setPixel32 function that I posted on slide number 21 will work perfectly. So I'm asked, what if it's a window? Do we still have the extra space? And that depends on how you do your graphics. So if we're using a window, in my framework, I actually have memory set aside for a window that you write on. And then when you call the flip routine, I actually manually copy that window onto somewhere else, onto the actual window in video memory. So you have a back buffer, that's right. You have a back buffer that where you draw on, and then I'm going to just copy that back buffer and store it onto the actual display. So in my framework, if you're drawing in windowed mode, I set aside a bunch of memory for you to write on. And you write on that memory, and that's called a back buffer. And then when you call the flip routine, then I just copy that memory that you just wrote on, and I paste it onto the actual display. So since I actually allocated that memory that you're writing on, the pitch is going to be the same as the resolution of the window. And you have to do that copy method when you're working with windowed mode. But if you're actually writing to the video card as you're doing in full screen mode, then you might have that pitch. But in regular mode, when you're working with Windows, in my framework at least, you'll never have a pitch component, since I actually allocate the memory for you. So hopefully that answers your question. There are actually several different ways. I guess I have some time. There are actually several different ways that you can do these copies and things. The general idea is that there's something called flickering that can occur. On a traditional CRT monitor, there's a scan gun that starts in the upper left-hand portion of the screen, and it scans left to right, left and right, all the way down the screen, and that takes some time. It does that about 30 times a second, or whatever your refresh rate is set at. And that takes some time. So if I just immediately write everything piece by piece to the video display, then what if I'm writing something and half of it gets written, but the other half doesn't, because my scan line that it's currently on just passed the middle of the screen. So I'm writing a big rectangle to the middle of the screen, and the scan line is right in the middle of the screen. So I write my rectangle, it displays the bottom half of my rectangle, but it has to go all the way to the bottom, and then all the way to the top again, and then all the way to the middle to draw the upper part of my rectangle. And this causes something called flickering. The display kind of flickers. And that's the best I can explain it as. And to eliminate this problem, then what we're going to do is we need to copy everything to the display at once. So we're going to wait until the scan gun is up in the upper left-hand part of the screen, and then we're going to display everything right at once. So fast that the scan gun has time to keep up with it. So then things aren't drawn in the middle of the screen. So one way of doing this is to allocate a bunch of memory, and you can scribble in that and draw on it. And then when we realize that the scan gun's in the upper left, we're just going to copy that memory really fast to the primary display. And that really fast copy is so fast that the scan gun has time to keep up with it, so it just displays the whole screen. And that's called double buffering. A second method of doing this, which is done in full screen mode, it can't be done in windowed mode, is called page flipping. And in page flipping, we actually have two versions of the back buffer, or two versions of the primary display, that are stored in memory. So your primary display is duplicated. And at all points in time, one of these two displays is shown to the user on the screen. So you see one of the two at a time. And 30 times a second, you're going to be viewing one of the screens, and you're going to be drawing to the other screen. And 30 times a second, then we're going to flip in between these two displays. So at first, the left display is going to be visible, and then second, the right display is going to be visible. And we're just going to flip between them really fast. And at all points in time, one of the displays is being viewed by the viewer, and the other one is being written to you. It is being used as the back buffer by the programmer, and things are being drawn to it. So this is a second method that takes up a little more memory on your video card, but it can be more effective in some situations, and that's called page flipping. So when you're in full screen mode in my framework, you're usually using page flipping. When you're in windowed mode, you're usually using back buffering. So that's just a quick demonstration on that. And the LCD displays don't have CRT guns, but they can still be affected by some of the same things. And actually, a lot of the games nowadays don't use that vertical retrace sync, so they actually don't even wait for the scan gun to get to the upper left-hand part of the screen. And this could be in part due to the LCD displays. But in general, there are still a lot of CRT monitors around, and they're a lot cheaper nowadays. So in general, if you don't want flicker in your games, you should probably use back buffering or page flipping. So, I guess I'll have to fix the to-do section as well. But I guess that I'm going to conclude Lecture 6. I'm going to post a new version of this slide online. I'm going to eliminate two of the slides and fix some of the errors that are in here. So I apologize for those. But the IDCC homework 3, you know, try to have it done by Wednesday, but if you don't, you know, that's fine. Just you know, contact us for if you need any help. I know it's a little confusing, and I had to kind of rush and get that done and get this done before I left for last weekend. But I'm going to work on these things and get them fixed. And later on this week, ITCC homework 4 should be ready. So hopefully that will be fun for you as well. So this is Danny, signing off. Thanks for coming.